Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome back. I appreciate you tuning in today. And before I get started, I want to say happy Father's Day to all of those fathers that are out there, including my two sons who have made me a proud grandparent. I hope everybody's day has been joyful. Before we get started, also, I want to talk about a positive feedback. I want to thank those of you who last week sent me some positive feedback and, you know, congratulated me on the show. I really appreciate that. It was very uplifting. At any rate, let's get down to business. We have some sad news to talk about. I guess in Trenton, New Jersey, they had an arts festival. I don't know if you heard on the news or not, but 20 people were wounded, 13-year-old boys in critical condition as a result of that. And I, you know, want to offer our condolences to all of those that got hurt in that melee. And hopefully everybody will come out of it okay, especially the 13-year-old boy who's in critical condition. Okay, you know, I want to also mention to you that this is your forum to speak out on also. So if you have any questions or comments, I want to send us an email. And we do have some emails that we're going to start off with here in a moment that I received after the last show. Give us a call at 818-602-4929. Again, that's 818-602-4929. Feel free to call in, ask some questions, comments. It's up to you. It's okay. It's your forum as well. Speak out. Our email address is listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. Again, listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. All right. The first email I want to read off has to do with asking about my opinion whether or not ordinary citizens should get these concealed weapon permits. Now, I know some states do that. Nevada, for one, I think in Texas. There's a few other states that offer that. But when people ask me this question, whether it's in some of the active shooter trainings that we offer by Potts and Associates or some of the seminars that I've done, I always caution people about these, we call them CCWs, about these CCWs. I think CCWs can get people in trouble. Instead of being smart enough to walk away sometimes, you may think because you have a loaded weapon on your person that you're going to be a little less cautious, I'll call it, as opposed to what would you do if you did not have that. And I think that you would be a little bit more clearer in your thinking if you didn't have it. When you pull out a gun in any circumstance, and I can tell you as a former police officer, those things are not easy to do. It creates problems for people. You pull out that gun because you have that CCW, and now you think that you're going to actually save somebody because there's some perpetrator that's committing a crime, or you know, you're in a restaurant or you're at work, whatever the circumstances may be. You got to understand that there's a lot of responsibility that goes along with that. And yes, I understand. You can go to the range and you can practice and you can become very good at shooting a target that's standing, you know, 25, you know, yards back, whatever the distance may be. But understand something. That target is not shooting back at you. There's nobody else around that target. That target's up against a wall. That's it. And when you even think about pulling out a weapon, if you have a concealed weapons permit and you turn around and you try to shoot somebody, think about something. A, they're shooting at you. B, the adrenaline is pumping. And there's a big difference between shooting at somebody that's shooting at you or even shooting at others. People can be scared. They can be nervous. There's all kinds of anxieties associated with that. So to me, what's the smartest recourse? Well, law enforcement says if you get in those kind of environments, run, hide, and then fight. Carrying a CCW in your wallet, which permits you to carry a weapon, to me, I'm not an advocate. I'll put it that way. Law enforcement personnel, yes. Former law enforcement personnel, yes. Because there is a big difference about what happens once that gun is pulled. So to answer your question to Tom from Monterey Park, Tom, I'm not an advocate of it. Make a long story short. Okay, let me read off another email that I got. Do you think all of the violence with these video games, so I guess what they're asking me about the video games and the violence in video games, have played a role with all of the younger generation? And I guess meaning that Sally says that this video game situation, does that, and with the violent video games, does that possibly influence the younger generation and, you know, creates for them this illusion out there about the use of violence? I don't know. You know, when I was younger, we went outside and played. We weren't on video games all day. I'm not a psychologist. I don't know. I don't know. That's not my area. But I did do one little research here on Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck had a best-selling book, Control, on Guns and Violence in America, is called, and insisted that the video generation gave us Sandy Hook in elementary schools, Columbine in high school, and Virginia Tech in college. Now, he seems to believe it will only get worse. You know, some of the things that I looked up when I saw this, you know, saw this email, I did some research on this, and the realities are, if you really think about it, a lot of the mass shootings aren't necessarily done by the younger generation. And I'm going to be speaking about some of that, by the way, when I talk about in the segment later on about preventing school shootings. I'll be discussing that a little bit more. And also reading off an email, by the way, that that I received from Pasadena associated with that. At any rate, if you look at it, a lot of the adults are the ones that are doing those mass shootings, not necessarily the younger generation. So if you go back in time, there's more of these issues with adults than there really are the younger generation. So I don't know if I subscribe to the feeling that the video games have created this. I don't know. But I will tell you, in terms of the school shootings, et cetera, that I did find some really good information that I'm going to share with you in that particular segment. Now, the other issue is that I received some information about selling assault weapons again. And I think I expressed my views on that, but I believe some people still had some comments about it, that they didn't think that selling assault weapons is the problem. It's not the weapon itself. It's the individual behind the assault weapon. Well, okay. That's one opinion, and those opinions are out there. Okay, because what I'm going to do now is move into my other area that I really wanted to talk about, which has to do with some employment law issues. So for those businesses out there, I can tell you that generally speaking, I feel that, in my opinion, I think businesses really get hurt with all of the different legislation. And this is California, and some of the states are different. I know I have national listeners. Maybe your states aren't as bad. But California and the California legislators, in my opinion, truly have no respect for businesses. The overregulation is driving businesses out. That's no secret. They're heading out. They're heading to Nevada. They're heading to Texas. They're heading to Arizona. And just to give you an idea, I'm going to go through some of the pending legislation that has a very good chance of probably getting past some of these, but we'll see. I don't have a crystal ball, but with all of the past legislation that's been passed that's adverse to the interests of employers. Now, look, I understand that some of these legislative enactments have to be done for the protection of employees. I have no issue with proper legislation that's protecting employees as well, so I want to make that clear. So I don't want to get a bunch of hate mail talking about the fact that I don't care anything about employees, because I actually give seminars regarding employees and a good work environment for employees. That's not what I'm saying. But some of these legislative enactments are so far over the top that it almost borders on ridiculous. Now, I'll give you an idea. They have one that's pending right now called AB 2841. And this has to do with the paid sick leave expansion. Now, this particular bill would expand the current paid sick leave law by requiring employers to provide more paid sick leave to employees. Now, understand something. July 1st of 2015, they already passed a law regarding mandatory sick leave in California. So that's, what, 3 years ago at this point. Now, you know, just to let, for those of you who are not aware of that, employers have to allow their employees to accrue at least 1 hour of paid sick leave for every 30 hours worked. Now, they may limit an employee's use of sick leave to 3 days, you know, or 24 hours per year, and may impose a carryover accrual cap of 6 days, 48 hours. Now, alternatively, an employer may provide at least 3 days, which is 24 hours of paid sick leave, up front to employees rather than allowing them to accrue it over time. Now, some employers like the upfront part because there's really some benefits to that, et cetera. But now is what they're talking about doing. Under the new bill, an employer who front loads paid sick leave would have to provide now at least 5 days up front. So now they're starting to increase it. Now keep in mind, this is the California law, possibly, that may change. That has nothing to do with the various cities within California or the counties. Because when this law was passed in July of 2015, as an example, L.A. County and like the city of Los Angeles, as an example, even though the law said, let's just say up front, 3 days, city of Los Angeles said 6 days. San Diego changed it. So even though the state law may change to this, that doesn't prohibit the counties or the various cities from, in fact, increasing the amount of days as long as they do the minimum of whatever the state's requiring. And that's a lot of days. Now, I'm not against people being ill, so please don't write to me talking about I'm against the sick, because that's not the case. As what I am saying is that as an employer, and the size of the employer makes a difference, now I think is what it's going to impact are vacation days, because I've already been seeing that with some of my clients. So if the state turns around and passes that now, as an example, it's a maximum of 5 days that you now have to give, what do you think the employers are going to do, especially the smaller employers, or even the larger ones, quite frankly, if you multiply that money times the number of employees that you're going to have to give them this time? It's going to be hard in terms of it financially, and is what they're going to do is reduce the number of sick days, excuse me, the number of vacation days, because vacation is still a non-mandated benefit, which means an employer doesn't even have to have a vacation policy. And that's going to create morale issues, in my opinion, for their employees and their work environment. But what else did some of these smaller employers are supposed to do? If they're going to get this bill passed through and now they got to give these mandatory 5 days now, I'm telling you, it's going to impact the benefits that are going to be offered to employees regarding vacation pay. So for those of you that might be against this, hey, do me a favor. You know, write to your congressman. Write to those people up there in Sacramento. And again, it's AB 2841 regarding the paid sick leave expansion, and try to dissuade them from passing this bill. Now, listen to this. I want you to also understand that an employer who allows employees to accrue, because all I talked about was the upfront. But if you're an employer who allows employees to accrue paid sick leave and you want to impose a cap on carryover, the accrual of unused sick leave could not use a cap of less than 10 days now. Now you're talking about that they can accrue up to 10 days. So I really honestly believe that this is going to seriously impact employers financially. It's going to impact employees from the benefits that are being offered in terms of vacation, which again is a non-mandated benefit. And a lot of people don't know that. They think that that's something required by law. It's not. So I think there's going to be a problem there with that. So, again, let's try and stay away from this one. Hopefully this one won't pass. But I'll keep you posted on that. We should know in the next few months whether or not that one's going to pass. Okay. The next one I want to talk about is called AB 2069. And this is employment protection for medical marijuana users. Okay. Look, for all you smokers out there, let me tell you the real deal. In California in 1996, the California Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court both established or held that California employers do not have to recognize the use of medicinal marijuana. Now, recently, within the last year, as many of you know, the California voters voted that the use of recreational marijuana was okay to do. Okay, so that got passed. What they didn't realize when they all went to the polls is that if they go to work and they get tested, that's a whole different ballgame. If they get tested because either they had a work-related accident or the reasonable suspicion, and they get tested, they can actually be terminated. So it's not what you think out there for those listeners that thought that it would be okay. It's not. This means if you're at a party over the weekend and your employer for some reason tests you on Monday and you test positive, you could be out of a job. Now, let me tell you about AB 2069. The Employment Protection for Medical Marijuana Users, this bill would amend the Fair Employment and Housing Act, and that's the California discrimination agency, to make it unlawful employment practice for an employer to take adverse action against an applicant or employee because of a positive drug test for marijuana. Now, this would be by a medical marijuana card holder, they say. Now, think about something. Medical marijuana card holder. Have you been to Venice Beach? And it's not even Venice Beach anymore. They are giving those cards away with these doctors. There's doctors out there that are giving these things away for $40. They go in to get some physical, and now all of a sudden they're a medical marijuana card holder. If the law changes so that now an employer can't take an adverse action against somebody who's a medical marijuana card holder, you know what they're going to do. These people, everybody's going to run out and get themselves a medical card for marijuana, and it's going to defeat the purpose. This is another example, in my opinion, of the way that California is fighting against the current administration in Washington, and I'm not getting into the politics of it, but they have made it very clear, you know, regarding the fact that that the use of marijuana is still a federally protected substance. It's a controlled substance from a federal standpoint. It's just that simple. So now they're going to give an avenue to people to be able to go out and get this. Now, let's face it. Here's the deal. There's already some states fighting against the fact that the current administration is seeking to enforce the federal marijuana laws. Washington is an example, state of Washington. California and a number of other states are fighting back right now, and the reason is very simple. The revenue. The taxes that they're generating from this is incredible. They don't want to let loose that money, and that's really the bottom line. That's what's really happening here. Now, I don't know if you've also heard on the news that now California is looking to have state-controlled banks as opposed to the federal-controlled banks because the growers of marijuana have not been able to, in fact, deposit cash, et cetera, in the federal banks because marijuana is illegal. So what are they doing? They're setting up now, possibly in California, and I'm going to use the word possibly, but this is what is supposed to be going on, these state banks, so that now these individuals can make deposits into the state banks because in the state of California, as an example, it's not illegal. So that's what they're doing to get around, once again, the administration in Washington. Now, none of this takes into account, in my opinion, about how individuals with these medical marijuana cards, and let's say they're driving or using heavy equipment at work, what's going to happen? What happens if they get hurt at work and now they test positive? And now the issue is, were they under the influence at the time that they got injured? So here we go with the workers' comp claims. This is not a good law, in my opinion. And once again, I would strongly urge businesses to write to their congressmen and their state senators, et cetera, and try to talk out against the AB 2069. And again, that has to do with the medical marijuana protections. Okay, here's another one for you. Next one is called SB 937. This one has to do with lactation accommodation. Now, for those guys that are out there scratching their heads asking about what the heck is lactation accommodation, that has to do with women who have had a child and now they're breastfeeders. And this permits the individual, while they're at work, to be able to express the milk from their breast so that they could store the milk for their baby, which is fine. Now, this law has been around for quite some time at this point, and the employer is supposed to do certain things in terms of making them comfortable in the work environment. Now, is what they're doing is expanding that law. Now, is what they're talking about is that the bill would require employers to provide a lactating employee with a lactation room other than the bathroom that, one, is close to the employee's work area, two, is free from intrusion, which makes sense, privacy is important, three, is shielded from view, four, is free of any toxic or hazardous chemicals, five, contains a surface on which to place a breast pump and similar items, six, has a place to sit, and seven, has access to electricity. Now, I don't really have a problem with this. I want to make that clear. I think that is something that we seriously need to consider, and I think that the privacy issue is very important. So it's not that I'm truly against this piece of it. And again, that part's already been around. Now, this law that they are seeking to expand would require employers to develop a written lactation accommodation policy, which they already should have in place anyway, and to respond to lactation accommodation requests within 5 days. Now, employers with less than 5 employees who believe they cannot comply with the law could petition the labor commissioner, and that's the Department of Labor Standards Enforcement, for an exemption based on undue hardship. We'll see if they're able to get it. Now, the bill provides for penalties for noncompliance. That makes sense. That's what California does. And avenues of recourse through the labor commissioner and or private right of action with recovery of attorney fees if a plaintiff actually sued an employer for not having the steps and accommodations that I just mentioned to you. So here we go again with lawsuits if the person feels that the accommodations don't meet their requirements. Now, unfortunately, the bill goes even farther. Is what it's also proposing is to require the California Building Standards Commission to adopt new rules that would require the construction of a lactation accommodation space in new or remodeled buildings that are at least 15,000 square feet. The bill also sets forth specific parameters for these newly constructed lactation rooms. So now's what they're talking about doing is creating lactation rooms. And again, that's on new buildings only or remodels. So if you don't remodel your building, then you're good to go. All right. The next one is called SB 826. And this has to do with female representation on a corporate board of directors. Now, this one I am not personally against in any way, shape, or form. There's a lot of businesses out there with the good old boy network that don't have women on their boards as board of directors, on the board of directors. This, to me, I'm with this one. I think that one is a pretty good one. I think that we need to get that kind of interaction. It's gender-based, and I think that we need to open the door to women being able to sit on these boards, et cetera. So for that one, I think I'm sending the message out there that one's a more positive one. I have no problem with it, but that is one of the ones that's pending. Now, here's one that's really going to touch you. AB 2946. That's expanded limitations period for labor board discrimination complaints. This bill would allow employees up to 3 years instead of 6 months to file a charge of discrimination with the Department of Labor Standards Enforcement. The bill would also amend Labor Code Section 1102.5 to allow for recovery of attorney fees by preventing a plaintiff, that's the person bringing the action. Now, once again, you're talking 3 years. That means if this bill passes, somebody from 2.5 years ago, so to speak, can now come back after you for this issue with the labor board for discrimination. That opens the door up to a lot of litigation, once again, in California. I would really speak out against that one. Again, write to your senators, write to your assembly people, whatever it's going to take to get this one knocked down, in my opinion, I think we need to do. And while you're writing that letter, here's another one. AB 1870, expanded limitations period for the Department of Fair Employment and Housing Charges. Now, for those of you who don't know what that is, that's the state agency that's set up to enforce discrimination claims. On a federal level, it's the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So each state has their own state discriminatory agency. California's is Department of Fair Employment and Housing. Now, This one, in my opinion, is going to be, once again, create a problem. This bill would allow employees up to 3 years instead of 1 year to file an administrative charge of discrimination or harassment or retaliation with the Department of Fair Employment and Housing. Therefore, this bill would effectively extend the statute of limitation for an employee to file a lawsuit against the employer to approximately 4 years from the alleged unlawful employment action, because they already had the 1 year. So now is what they're telling us. If this bill passes, somebody now can come back. Now think about that. Somebody can come back from 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and say, oh, they discriminated against, you know, against me based on my race, religion, age, disability, California, sexual orientation, all of these different areas, religion. I mean, this swings the doors open to, once again, more litigation. This is what I meant when I said earlier, where all of this overregulation is just driving employers out of the state. And if the employees leave the state, guess what? What's going to happen to the economy? People are going to be out of work. It's going to create problems. You know, again, I don't like to get into the politics of it, but these are the things that we have to think about. And that, to me, is a big one. I mean, plaintiff attorneys that are out there listening to this, they're probably jumping up and down, and they're hoping it goes through, because it is going to create more litigation for employers. Okay. AB 1867, we're getting ready to wrap this up. By the way, if you have any questions about this, give me a call at 818-602-4929, or you can email me, listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. You know, these discrimination claims, I should add, you know, it's kind of the work that we do as well. We help employers, you know, respond to discrimination claims either on a state or federal level or at the labor board level. We assist them with all of that. So we're pretty good at it. I've been at it for 38 years now, and we kind of know what we're doing. So if we could be of any assistance to you out there, just obviously send us an email. And yes, that was a little marketing pitch that I just made, so bear with me. At any rate, let's talk about another one. AB 1867, records retention, sexual harassment complaints. This bill would require employers with 50 or more employees to retain records of sexual harassment complaints. Are you ready for this? For 10 years. Now, you know what this is all about. This is all about what's happening on the news and all of these issues that are cropping up with that. So 10 years, you're going to have to hold on to those records on any sexual harassment complaint. Now, I'm not an advocate of sexual harassment, people being sexually harassed. I do a lot of training for employers and managers on the what the law is and not to be doing it, et cetera. We also train employees so they also understand what it is and what it is not. So I'm not an advocate of sexual harassment for sure. So I get it. But 10 years is a long time for record retention. And that's definitely outside of the statute of limitations, because I just told you it was going to be going up to 4 years. So why would you have to keep it the other 6 years? I don't know. Sometimes these legislators, in my opinion, don't think this out. Okay. Here's another one. SB. Oh, by the way, AB means assembly bill. So all the ones that I gave you with AB, those are all for your assemblymen. Those are the ones dealing with that. All right? AB, assembly bill. Now we're on the Senate bills. And again, this is the state. So here's one for you, SB 1038, personal liability for retaliation. This bill would provide for individual liability for retaliation under the Fair Employment and Housing Act. Under the current law, an individual may be held personally liable for harassment, but not for discrimination or retaliation. So here you go. Now, once again, this means for all you managers and supervisors out there, once again, they are drawing you into the crosshairs for claims against you personally. Now, they already passed January 1st of 2017, where managers and supervisors in the state of California are now personally liable for wage and hour violations. That's already there. That means one of your employees could take you to the labor board or get an attorney and take you to Superior Court. Now they're expanding on this other one with the liability for retaliation, as I just told you. So, individual may be held personally liable for harassment, not for discrimination or retaliation. That's all changing. The last one that I want to talk to you about is SB 1300, Failure to Prevent Discrimination or Harassment. This bill will change existing law by providing that where an employee alleges a claim for failure to prevent discrimination or harassment, the employee, get ready, the employee need not prove the underlying discrimination or harassment occurred in order to state a valid claim. Do you understand what that means? They don't even have to prove it. They don't have to prove it. All they have to do is make the allegation and say that the employer failed to prevent the discrimination or harassment. Separately, the bill would also prohibit a release of the discrimination claims as a condition of employment or continued employment or in exchange for a raise or bonus. The bill would also prohibit an employer from requiring an employee to sign a non-disparagement agreement or other document that prevents the employee from discussing unlawful acts, including sexual harassment, etc. Well, there it is. Those are all of the bills that are pending that I want to talk about this week. But there's one more, SB 1340-43, Sexual Harassment Prevention Training. And again, this one, in my opinion, is not a bad one. This bill will require employers with five or more employees to provide sexual harassment prevention training to all employees by 2020 and once every 2 years thereafter. They already do that for managers. It's called AB 1825, and that's been in effect since 2005. So it's out there. Okay, that gives you an idea about what in California businesses and employers are up against. Those are the pending bills. My opinion is get out those pens and papers and write to wherever you have to write to, and let's see if we can't get some of those knocked down as opposed to passing. All right, again, if you have any questions or anything, call it 818-602-4929, or you can email us at listenupwithjp@postonassociates.com. Okay, I want to read an email to you, and we're going to get on to the final segment here, talking about preventing school shootings. And I received an email that I want to read to you. It says, I'm responding to your future data discussion, how to prevent school shootings. Now, this was sent by Alan in Pasadena. He says, number one, when a school is infiltrated by gang members, you can't unless you are able to permanently remove all of them from said school prior to the shooting. This, of course, would require ensuring that none ever return. Obviously, such a removal would create an anger and an excuse to start blasting away. Number two, support law enforcement's ongoing efforts. Three, gain greater methods of intelligence gathering. Four, hold parents responsible for the actions of minor children. Five, probably most important, quit being so politically correct and encourage the return of a Bible-based ethics and morals. Encourage students to carry and read their Bibles. Begin each day with publicly read Bible passages. The truths found in the book, in this particular book, have applications to every part of living. Well, I'm not going to get into the religious part of it because I don't want to. There's people out there that have their own faith and faith-based and non-faith, etc. So I'm not going to get into that piece of it. But I think some of these questions or comments that he has raised is right in line with some of the things I'm going to be talking about with the preventing school shootings. So let's get busy with that. Let's talk about an 18-year-old honor student who brought guns and a homemade bomb to school one day. He set off the fire alarm and shot at the janitors and firefighters who responded. The boy got caught and hung himself while awaiting trial. Now, I know this story sounds as current as today's media's headlines, but believe it or not, guess when this happened? 1974. School shootings, you guys, are not new. This goes back a long time. There's no reason why school shootings occur and no one type of student who becomes a shooter. I did a little research, and I still have access to some of my government secure websites, and I got a hold of a summary of a U.S. Secret Service report that they wrote a few years ago. And I really thought some of the information in here was good, and that's why I wanted to share it with you. Because the information that I found really dispels the myths and stereotypes about school shooters. Children who attack can be any age and from any ethnic group, race, or family situation. And I'll tell you, contrary to assumptions that some of our youth just snap, they don't. They plan. It just doesn't happen as simple as some of us may think that it does. Now, according to this report that I read, it emphasized the importance of paying attention and listening to our young people. More than a handful of adults, parents, teachers, school administrators, counselors, coaches, and law enforcement can make an important contribution to and play a key role in preventing violence on school grounds. You have to start paying attention. We've been engaged by some schools that we're trying to assist them because of what happened at the in Florida and some of the other schools. We have to start paying attention, and that's the message to all of the schools. Young people who need help often do not keep it a secret. They may exhibit obvious warning signs either through behavior or remarks, such as voicing problems or grievances, complaining about persecution or bullying, or showing signs of depression. We are missing it. Some of them show signs of desperation, and the adults around them are missing it. Now, the Secret Service apparently found that when young people plant targeted violence, they often tell at least one person about their plans. They even give out specifics before the event takes place and obtain weapons they need, usually from where? Their own homes or relatives' homes. See, there it goes again when we start talking about parents, as Alan mentioned in his email, about parents taking a responsibility. If these children have access to weapons, see, the problem is that parents don't always think that it's, my child can never do this. I don't know whose child anymore can't do it. So any of this is a possibility. We need to secure those weapons. A more important effort in prevention may be to ensure that young people have opportunities to talk and connect with caring adults. And I do this in my seminars. I talk about the same exact thing where employees who have had issues with violence in the workplace, and sometimes it's what the problem is that the supervisor is not listening as well. And they get desperate. They feel that they've been bullied. Think about it. All of this has a connection. It's the individuals around them that are not paying attention. And that's what needs to happen. Now, let's talk about what we know. Let's talk about attackers and their plans. Prior to most incidents, the attackers told someone about his idea or plan. According to the Secret Service report, in more than three-fourths of the cases examined, the attacker told a friend, schoolmate, or sibling about his idea for a possible attack before taking action. In one case, an attacker made comments to at least 24 friends and classmates about his interest in killing other students, building bombs, or carrying out an attack at the school. Some of the conversations were long enough that peers conveyed detailed information about the plans, including the date that it would happen. And yet, that information is not always given to the authorities. Kids just listen to other kids. But what are the parents doing? I remember there was a story about last year sometimes where a father, and I believe it was in the Orange County area, who had some suspicions about his daughter. I think she was 13 or 14 years old. Now, first of all, nobody ever thinks about, you know, the ladies, the daughters, the girl, so to speak, about carrying out these kind of acts. And so this was really kind of surprising to me, to be perfectly honest with you. But the father actually got on her computer and saw some things that she had done, inquired about, said, etc., and actually found out that she was planning something that was going to be worse than Columbine. And he actually alerted the police. Good for him. We need more parents to pay attention. These kids are drawing some of this stuff off the internet. Pay attention, parents. Don't think it can't happen to your child. It might. Now, according to the report, it also identified a major barrier to the prevention of targeted school violence. And nearly all of the cases who they did the report on, the person who was told about the impending incident was a peer, and rarely did anyone bring the information to an adult's attention. It's important, therefore, that threat assessment inquiries involve efforts to gather information from anyone who may have contact with the student in question. It is also important to decrease barriers that prevent students who have information from coming forward. We have discussed that with some of our school clients. You have to be able to have a forum by which these kids can speak up for any of these issues, bullying, etc. I remember reading a couple of years ago where a young student, female student in that particular case, where she had been bullied to the point where she turned around and committed suicide. Now, she didn't take any action against anybody else, but it's still a loss of life, and it's a person who took their own life. And bullying, you know, come on, bullying is not new. We know that. Bullying goes back from when we were kids. It goes back a long time and probably even before that. The whole issue is talking to somebody, but more importantly, people who are going to listen to what the person is saying, the person who's been bullied, the person that's a victim. And again, I will stress, it's not just children. It is also in the work environment. Supervisors don't always listen. They just need to get the job done. They look at these as situations where they're adults. Handle it. Everybody can't. Everybody's stress levels are different. You hear about workplace shootings all the time. Here's the deal. We have to start doing something, and we have to start listening. All right? Anybody has any comments about this, by the way, can call in 818-602-4929. Again, 818-602-4929. Now, they also find out where school and investigators need a thoughtful, effective system for handling, analyzing any information that is provided. So it's not really just a question of listening. Is what do you do with the information once you get it? You got to be able to analyze it, which means that you need to be able to have people who are trained, in my opinion, in this area so that they, in fact, can analyze the information and to be able to proceed with the information as need be. All right? Now, some attackers did make threats. Most did not threaten their target directly. Now, let's see. Hold on a second. I think we got a caller in here that wants to give an opinion. Hold on a second here. Hello. You're live on the air with Jim Potts at LA Talk Radio. Do you have a question or comment to share?
I sure do, Jim.
Hey, how you doing today? Where are you?
Oh, good.
Where are you calling from? Where are you?
This is Jim from New Jersey.
Oh, okay, New Jersey. Oh, there was a shooting in Trenton last night. I hope you weren't there.
Yeah, I didn't even know about it. You mentioned it on the air, and I flipped on the TV and said, yeah, wow, there was a shooting.
Yeah.
It never ends. It seems like there has to be an end to this, but it doesn't seem like it's going to happen anytime soon. The question I had, I'm talking about preventing school shootings, it's a complicated issue, but one thing that can be done fairly quickly is if they hired more security guards for schools. Because the recent shooting in Texas had was stopped by a security guard, and it probably would have been more loss of life if there hadn't been a security guard there. Well, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that has merit to it. A lot of the schools are working on such limited budgets at one point, let's just put it that way, that they probably could not afford to have a full-time security guard, et cetera. Now, from what I understand, a lot of the inner-city schools, you know, may have some type of security and things like that. The gentleman in the email that sent it to me earlier was talking about gangs as an example. I look at that. That's a tough scenario also, because if you have an area where there's a lot of gangs that have come into the school, the gang members are actually going to school there, et cetera, that is going to be kind of tough. But some of those schools also have security teams. They have their own police forces, as I understand it, for the school, and I think that does help. But we have to keep in mind, Jim, that the word soft targets, or the two words soft targets are where security guards or law enforcement are not. So if you look at some of these incidents that have taken place, they don't generally have that. Now, yes, we're gravitating more in that direction, and I would agree with that. Now, remember the Stoneman Douglas shooting in Parkland, Florida. Now, there was a law enforcement person who was there, and he did not take the action that people thought that he should have taken. So there's a situation where even though you may have had somebody from law enforcement or, you know, or as a security guard that was there, we have to take into consideration some of these people have automatic rifles or, you know, like these AR-15s, et cetera. These security guards are probably not going to be carrying those types of weapons. They're probably just going to have a handgun. You follow what I'm saying? As opposed to these automatic rifles. And it takes
But in Texas, it made a difference, though, because they, even though the kid was armed, he had a shotgun. He didn't have an AR-15. But it's still better than nothing. I know what you're saying about school budgets and everything, but
right.
You know, you have to that, and people are going to say, well, you can't afford this, but you have to ask yourself what price you're going to put on a kid's life.
Well, I fully agree with that, Jim.
What price is it worth it to save some money? What's more important, money or kids' lives?
Well, the kids' lives, I think, are very important, and I think some of the schools are gravitating towards trying to figure out something to do. I spoke last week about the issue about whether or not they should be arming teachers, and as I said then, I don't think that's the deal to go. But to have somebody, you know, look, they've got ex-law enforcement person out there that are retired that may love to have a job like that in their retirement year. They could be effective people for these schools as security guards, and those are people that probably under the pressure will probably react properly. If we're talking about just regular security guards, some of those regular security guards don't really have the training from having been in scenarios, Jim, where they're going to be able to respond effectively. Now, the one in Texas, I agree. And I think he even got wounded, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he did.
That's right. He anteed up. He did what he was supposed to do. And we're going to encounter guys out there that may do that, some that may not do that. So I would say that I think that that's good, but I think we need other things in place as well. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm not saying that hire just regular security guards, the typical security guards that just go through the motions. And you're right. There are a lot of retired police officers. There's a lot of veterans who know how to handle a weapon, who would know what to do in a combat situation, that could make a difference. I mean, it might even be a deterrent. Now, in Texas, it wasn't a deterrent. You know, the kids have mental problems, and sometimes they want to die. It might not be a deterrent. But who's to say in another school where they have three or four security guards around the high school all day long that would make a kid think twice about coming there with a gun?
Listen, it
might work.
You know what? It might work. I think that should be part of the plan, and obviously not the entire plan, so I do agree with you on that. Some schools are putting in, you know, and some schools already have them, where they got to go through medical detectors. I know some of these inner city schools have that because they were forced to. And some of these other schools probably never thought about it, but may in fact be gravitating in that direction as well. But, you know, these kids that are having these issues, Jim, goes to what I was just talking about, you know, regarding the fact that they've told other people. See, we still have to take the whole safety or planning of this into consideration. Your point is very well taken, but it's just one aspect of it. And I think that teachers, siblings, et cetera, need to be aware. Go ahead.
Well, I agree with you 100% that one answer is not arming teachers. Teachers are paid to teach, not to be security guards.
And that's true. And I'm sure some of them are dedicated to the cause, but I'm not sure if some of them are going to be willing. Now, I know that in some of them, like in Stoneman Douglas in Parkland, Florida, there were teachers there who actually risked their lives and lost their lives as a result of helping the students. And I think that that's really good. And some people argue that if that person had a gun, they could have done something. Who knows? It's kind of hard to speculate after the fact. But I do believe that we do need to take a more positive look at this moving forward for sure. You know, so Jim, I want to thank you for calling in. I really appreciate
it.
And have a nice day. And sorry about
you
what
too.
Happened in Trenton. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Jim that called in, and I did appreciate that. I have not gotten through everything that I want to get through, so I want to talk to you about next week. Next week, we're going to continue this discussion regarding the schools because, as you can see, this is a hot-button topic. And next time when we do come back, we're going to be talking about attackers and how they make their plans, et cetera. We're going to be talking about how easy the access should or should not be to be able to get these weapons, et cetera. So we're going to do a part two to this, and to make sure we have enough time, we'll actually start off the session next week with the remainder of this piece. But, you know, again, this is a forum for you to speak up on, and I'm glad that Jim called. But anybody that has any questions or wants to speak out on this issue or any issue that's impacting us nationally, I just don't believe that the government is doing enough in these areas, and I think that we need to get the message out about people being more vigilant, et cetera, when they're out there paying attention to their environment. This report that I just talked about, what the Secret Service talked about assessments, you know, and site assessments. And I can tell you that my team is out there doing site assessments, and we're out there writing procedures and protocols to follow. And, you know, these things are important, and we're doing a lot of active shooter training. So if we can be of an assistance with you on that, hey, just let me know and give us a call at 818-602-4929 if you want to be on the air. Send me an email, listenupwithjp@possenassociates.com. Okay, as I close out this segment, I want to say happy Father's Day again to all of those dads that are out there. I'm also going to try next week to get to managing threats of violence in the workplace as well. So we will cover not only the schools, but we also would have covered violence in the workplace. All right? All right, you've been listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts at LA Talk Radio. Now it's time to close out the show. And I do want to remind you, as I will every week, to be aware, be vigilant, and be safe. Have a good week. Bye.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.